You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, a weekly show with Alexander Schacht, Benjamin Pieske and Sam Gardner, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science and serve patients without becoming overwhelmed by work. This is part two of our episode number 200, which was recorded live. If you haven't listened to episode one yet, then just skip back in your podcast player. This is also available as a video on our homepage show. So just go over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find episode 200 there. Have fun with the next couple of guests of this episode. Rapid fire, 10 minutes per guest. And with that, we move over to Steve Pike. How are you doing?
Hi, Alex. Yeah, good, thank you. I will just say, having listened to the other speakers already, this is like going to one of those restaurants where they have a tasting menu. You get a little taste of very different, each very exquisite little pieces. And I must say, I'm going to follow up on some of these speakers I've heard about already today. So thank you for this opportunity.
Yeah, hopefully others will kind of get a inspiration of all the different podcast episodes that are out there. I calculated you can now spend actually a couple of days listening to the podcast uninterruptedly, but yeah, maybe you can just pick out a couple of these. Don't forget to eat and to sleep while listening to the podcast.
You need to take a sabbatical for doing the podcast.
Yeah. So, you recently had an interesting change, something that I did as well. I changed from a pharma company into a CRO, and you did the same. Tell us a little bit about this and what drove this change? Yeah, and what do you hope to get out of the CRO
business? Yeah, I mean, it's probably fair to say it's a bigger change than I expected in some respects. But I wish, you know, reflecting back to what Diana and Ian were saying earlier, you know, I can't honestly say this was part of my big plan for the rest of my career. It was more accident than design, I would say. But I will say there were three ingredients, and I think, again, very much resonating with what Diana particularly said earlier. Firstly, it was an interesting looking job. So the company I'm now with, Parexel, they were looking to really build on the foundations they've made around the way they use data. So real world data, clinical data, everyone's talking about data these days and the technology and the analytics that go with it in order to realize the value from that data. So this is not a new idea, but I think as it was presented to me, this looked like a job which would allow me to take something and really accelerate it. So that was kind of exciting in itself. I think the second ingredient was the manager, and my now manager was someone that I'd known, if you like, from the other side of the table. So when I'd been in a pharma company purchasing CRO services, I'd had the chance to meet this guy. And honestly, for those of you who've been working more than a few years, I think you'll all appreciate the importance of a good manager. I knew Cy was a good guy. I had a lot of respect for him as a scientist, as a medic. And I was pretty confident that I could work for him and enjoy it. And then the third ingredient, I think, was the opportunity for growth, for learning, for development. And although I'm, 25 years now into my career in pharma, and I've worked alongside a lot of really good people, I've learned an awful lot, particularly from people in other disciplines, actually. And for those who don't know me well, I'm a statistician. By training, I've spent most of my career as a statistician. But it's learning from people in other disciplines that really helps you be a good drug developer. And in the end, for those of us who've been in the pharma sector for more than a short period, you realize quickly it's about drug development fundamentally. That's what we're employed for. We bring technical competence, but we are developing drugs. And in this job in particular, you know, there was clearly an organization with smart people, with a passion like myself for developing medicines. And actually, I like the culture a lot. And as I was meeting the leaders of the organization, the culture felt good. It was surprising to me, actually embarrassingly so, to hear just how focused they were on patients, just in the way that when I was in pharma, we talked about the patients and the medicines that that we were delivering for them. So probably, as I said, accidentally, I find myself in the CRO, but the ingredients looked right. And now that I'm inside it, actually, I find a company which is, you know, a really enjoyable place to be. It's a sector which I think is doing a lot to contribute to the development and discovery of new medicines. You know, I think I would recommend it as much to anyone as I would the pharma sector, which I've enjoyed equally.
So, Alexander, is it the same for you?
Yep. Yep. It is the same for me. However, for me, it wasn't so much of an accident. It was very, very intentional. I had built teams in two pharma companies around the post-regulatory world. And I really wanted to help not just one company, but many companies. And the only area where you can really do this is from a CRO perspective, because then you have the freedom to really work with everybody and drive things forward across the industry. And so that was one of my main reasons for changing. There's actually not a full episode about this and my considerations coming up next year. I have already recorded it, like so many others, but this is coming next year. Steve, you have a really interesting title, and there's one word that I stepped over: digital. It's a big buzzword within our industry. What does it mean to you?
It's a great question, and just a small meander, if I may. When I was joining Parexel and talking with my new boss about what to call the group, we had some names for the group which had more buzzwords than you could shake a stick at, honestly. In fact, it got to the point where I'm thinking, you cannot say the name of this group without drawing breath. That's a problem. So, but anyway, back to your question, what does digital mean? I tend to see it in a way as part of a triumvirate, particularly in our sector. I think of digital data and analytics as sort of the three legs of the stool that allow what we want to do to happen. And by which I mean, you know, if you like, the data is where you begin. Data is in the healthcare setting, in our clinical studies, there's a lot of data around and a lot of potential use cases for it. And we know over the last several years, there's been a lot of work done to standardize it, to aggregate it, to make it more accessible. The digital piece then for me is the technology and the software, the hardware and the software that bring together the means by which we can then access that data, ingest it, aggregate it, link it, store it, and then interrogate it ultimately. And then that's the analytics piece, which is about really understanding what is the data telling us, where is the value, and how do we realize the value of that data? So I think when I talk about digital, it's, if you like, it's sort of shorthand for me for the technology and the software. And I suppose the thing I would sort of say just a little bit further on that then is, so what is good digital? You know, what makes it digital? What makes the technology helpful or unhelpful? And what makes it useful for us? And I think it's really predicated on the notion that it allows us to do things quickly, almost in real time, if possible, that it is, you've architected your technology in such a way that you're not tied to a rebuild of the technology every time you want a new application. So it has to be, in some degree, future-proofed. The sort of plug and play mentality, the iPhone, if you like, which we're all used to working with. In the data space, good digital means something like the flexibility, the ease of use, the adaptability, the future-proofing, the technologies that we live with in our home offer. They need to be available for us in the office. And I think increasingly that's possible. So, you know, digital is coming alive and is becoming meaningful in a way that I think for a long time it's really been an ideal which we never achieved. It's definitely moving forward in a very helpful way now.
Yeah. Digital is also a big word beyond
you know, all the clinical development. Yes, there's lots of things happening in terms of e-commerce and social media and emails and all these kind of different things, where in the, you know, if you look back 20 years ago, it was mostly about face-to-face interactions between sales reps and, you know, people from healthcare providers. And now it's much more about really kind of emails, webinars, and these other digital tools.
And in a way, I'd be remiss if I didn't use this opportunity just to point out what, well, I think, again, we already know, we all here know, this audience knows for sure. AI, ML, natural language processing, these things are more than words now. They are reality. You know, when we come into the office, the tools we use in our home, they use these almost ubiquitously. And I think there's massive untapped opportunity through allying thoughtful use of those mechanisms with data, with digital. And that's why I think this is so exciting. Even a man of my age can genuinely be excited about the opportunity this creates for us and for our industry.
Yeah. And Sam touched on, you know, these opportunities in terms of technology earlier already.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's not just leave it to the kids. We can all do something with this.
Thanks so much, Steve, for coming to the call and sharing your thoughts on here. So maybe we can chat a little bit longer about these kind of things in an upcoming episode next year.
I'd love to do that.
We are moving over to the next guest. It's really, really fast turning and lots of different opportunities to talk about. Now we are talking again about something more methodological. Hi, Daniel, how are you doing?
Hi, good morning, good afternoon. I'm doing good, thanks. How are you?
Very good. We actually talked about this thing earlier today already, about matching adjusted indirect comparisons. And quite some time ago when we did the podcast episode, it was something much more kind of new. There were, you know, a couple of examples out there. But nowadays, it is nearly mainstream, I would say, especially as it has now its place in the guidelines, a NICE guideline. So, Daniel, that's quite an achievement for such a method to get into, you know, a guideline that is relevant for payers in the UK and surely beyond the UK, because many of other payers look into kind of these guidelines. What are kind of your key takeaways from this guideline?
Yeah, thank you. And I think this was a fair summary of the method. So the so-called matching adjusted indirect comparison. So we already talked about software and visualization. So today I came up with pen and paper just to bring us all on the same page, so to say. So this is basically the situation we are talking about. Yeah. It's all about indirect comparison. So in the case you don't have head-to-head data at hand, yeah. So imagine you have maybe one or two studies which compare treatment A to C, and then maybe you have another study which compares the same treatment C but with another treatment B, and you are actually interested in the comparison of A versus B. And yeah, so the gold standard, as we all know, is do a randomized controlled clinical trial. But in many cases, and due to many reasons, this is most often not feasible. But in this case, statistics can help. And I think one example which is really quite popular is the so-called Bucher approach, which, so to say, compares the differences of the treatment effects of A versus C to B versus C. And in some cases, and I think this is one reason why we have this method now in the NICE guideline, observe some differences in the baseline characteristics across trials. So, for example, You have a mean age of 40 in one trial, and in the other trial you have a mean age of 50, and you know from your medical colleagues that age has an effect of how effective the treatments are, then the classic adjusted indirect comparison or the Bucher method, this will probably result in biased results, so to say. And then I think 6 or 7 years ago, the matching adjusted indirect comparison method has been published, I think, in oncology first. And now, as Alexander mentioned, it has made its way into the NICE technical document. It's document number 18 for those of you who want to take a closer look. And I think it's really a great method. So like all statistical methods, it has pros and cons, but really for the case that you really need to compare two treatments where you don't have data at hand and where you know that the patients in both on both sides differ in important characteristics, which may bias the results, then I think this method is really a good alternative to the Bucher one and a good addition, for example, to a network meta-analysis. Yeah, and so Alexander, you mentioned that this method now is implemented in NICE. So it's when you look to this technical support document, you can really identify a couple of situations where NICE agrees to submit this kind of method. Yeah, and first of all, it's or the basic message really is you can do it. You are allowed to submit it. And the second method really then is if you really can build up some kind of this network, then use it. Yeah, don't do any unanchored comparison, just A versus B, but make use of this common comparator C in this case here. This is really the other message. And then it's really all about identification of so-called treatment effect modifier. So these are just baseline characteristics where you know that, as I said, they can influence the effectiveness or safety of your treatment. And this is really where you need to put a lot of work into when you want to apply this method. I think from the technical side, this is all straightforward. Even the code is available on the NICE webpage, but you really need to work on the understanding of the treatment effect modifier. So, for example, if you know or if you guess that, for example, age has an influence, yeah, you need to work closely with your medical colleagues. You need to look into medical guidelines if this characteristics is really identified as an important treatment effect modifier. And then you also need to show it from a statistical point of sight. Yeah. So for example, you need to show that a change in the age has really an impact on the effectiveness. Yeah, and for example, there's no gold standard yet for both for the medical and for the statistical evaluation, so to say. But for example, you can apply some kind of regression models. Yeah, you can investigate your own data to see which impact has age, for example, and then put this together with your medical findings, and then put together the statement that this is a treatment effect modifier, and then you can and need to adjust for this within your indirect comparison. And this is then when this method comes alive, so to say.
Yeah, that is a really important thing to have in mind. Doing a thorough review of what are the covariates you need to adjust for to get a as unbiased estimate as possible. Flip side of it is the more you adjust, the more potentially you lose the effective sample size. And so it really makes sense to only adjust for those where you need to adjust. and not just kind of throw in all the things that you have collected, because that can have a negative impact. So thanks so much, Daniel. That was a really, really nice summary of the guideline, and it's a really relevant one. With that, let's move over to the next guest. And for this episode, I didn't only want to have, you know, previous guests. I also wanted to have some listeners, some longtime listeners that have provided me with some feedback. And so here I'm really happy to have Chris Miller, who I recently met virtually and was really happy to hear that he's a listener of this podcast. Hi, Chris. How are you doing today?
Hi, Alexander. Doing fantastic.
Great to have you on the show. Since when have you been listening to the Effective Statistician?
So I came across the podcast probably about 3 years ago. And I've got to say, since the pandemic, I started really kind of upping my listening hours as a way to kind of connect with our community, which has been, you know, almost solely virtual for the last year and a half, 2 years.
That's interesting. It's actually against the trend. Most of the podcasts have actually decreasing numbers through the pandemic, I think, because people were not commuting anymore. And that's probably one of the main, you know, times where people listen to podcasts. Same for me, besides kind of running and exercising is, I think, the other area. What are kind of your most favorite episodes that you have listened to?
Yeah, so I think you and I have a common interest, and probably a common interest among a lot of us on today's call, is how do we as statisticians develop ourselves as drug developers and influence the organization? So I'm really drawn to the podcasts that talk about career development, taking a risk, getting outside our comfort zone. There are a number of podcasts around how do introverts influence, and also ones around how do you make a career change? How do you do something that's uncomfortable? And again, I think about this a lot, especially in the context of the pandemic, where some of our natural organic ways of interacting with people, you know, sitting around the table at a study team meeting, are a bit different now. They're so staged, so orchestrated, that some of the techniques I used to use and I used to encourage around, you know, as you're leaving a meeting, have a one-on-one with someone at the coffee machine in between meetings, get to know them a little bit, ask about your weekend. All those things have intangible benefits around building your network that make it more comfortable for folks to approach you later on and say, hey, Chris, I wanted to ask you a question about such and such that you said during the meeting. You know, now that most of us have not been able to do that so much, it's like you have your Zoom call, that's over, you go to your next Zoom call. There's no 2 minutes in between meetings. So I've been listening to the podcasts around influencing with that in mind, around we need to have more tools. We need to know of more techniques. And I love hearing about other people's experiences of challenges they've faced and little things they've done to overcome them.
So what is your technique now that you don't have this kind of coffee machine interactions anymore, where you walk out of a meeting and you both walk to the coffee machine and during that kind of better relate to people?
Yeah, and so at AstraZeneca, we've been kind of dipping our toes back into the water of returning to site. And my personal technique is I'm coming in every day. So I've discovered I really miss it. And it's kind of validating my hypothesis that those unplanned kind of organic interactions are really valuable. So, you know, you're running into someone at the coffee machine in the staircase. You know, other techniques I've used is I've purposefully put in time in my weekly calendar for networking. Mm-hmm. And that's tough. And it's kind of tough to give that as advice because I recognize that if you're in a more senior role, that's maybe easier to do than if you're just starting off, you're very junior. You know, it takes some courage to just, you know, put 5 minutes on someone else's calendar to say, I just want to say hi. I just want to kind of talk.
Yeah, but I think there's also the opportunity to just, you know, reach out to people via, you know, the chat and other things. And at Veramet, we use Google for that. And then you can just drop in even a meeting into the chat and go from there. I've used similar techniques, you know, also with the Windows equivalent. So that's possible as well. Sam, what are your thoughts?
Well, I found that I struggle a bit with that too, where I've worked from home for a long time. So I've been isolated from a lot of the other people that I work with. And being the face-to-face communication can be really key where you have those opportunities to do that. But how do you get past now the fact that a lot of people just maybe aren't even going to come back to the office? I have some ideas on that, but I'm wondering what you're thinking, Chris, like, for people who just really aren't going to be in the office that much, how do you have those informal conversations that help develop relationships and let you learn things that you wouldn't learn in a more structured meeting?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'm not sure I have the perfect answer other than agreeing with you. It's important. So we need to figure out how we work that into our schedule. I don't want us to become, you know, solely task oriented. Mm-hmm. I sort of reflect back on my first job in industry, and one of my key members of my network to this day, so 30 years later, is somebody I never worked on the same project with. I knew him because we sat next to each other on the floor plate, and we'd kind of, you know, overhear a little bit of each other's conversations and say, oh, that was interesting because I'm working on a similar project. How are you approaching it? And then, you know, we became friends, we became colleagues. And I'm thinking, it's like, would I have even known him in a solely virtual world? Because I wouldn't have even known to schedule a networking appointment with him. And even if I did, it would have been kind of weird out of the blue to say, hey, let's have a meeting. Yeah, so I wonder if we need to consciously think of how we're going to approach that as a discipline going forward. That, and I worry about the risk if we don't, right? Because if we don't, I worry we can regress 20 years back to being, oh, you're the numbers people, you know, you're kind of deliver the TLFs and, you know, give us the sample size. And we kind of regress a bit in how we've achieved the role of kind of drug developers.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I completely agree. What is interesting is that it's now much more easier to connect with people via, for example, LinkedIn. So I've made several connections to people via LinkedIn over, especially kind of the last year, where I, you know, commented on people's posts and then went a little bit backwards and forwards. We connected, and that even led to some podcast episodes. So I think that is, you know, the thing you need to be open to it. As you said, you know, step outside of your comfort zone and contact people despite might, you know, being a little bit awkward at the beginning. But if you have a similar interest and you really care about the other person and not just kind of pitch some kind of product, then I think that can lead to quite nice results.
Yeah, and I think you can also do it a little bit more with written communication. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when we used to get a lot of written communication, letters, memos done on typewriters, not on computers. and that worked back then. It worked back then. But what I find now is with the written communication now, it's very instant, right? You can send a text message, you can get on Teams or whatever messaging app you have and send a quick message. And what you have to be comfortable with is sort of that asynchronous back and forth. Like I may send a message and that person may not respond right away. Right. So it's like a little short letter that I put into the post, into the mail, but I need to wait until they're ready to respond. And I think you also have to maybe be a little bit more courteous too, because it's really easy just to be very short, send like these short sentences that don't even have a complete sentence structure. And I think you have to write better when you send these messages to convey not just the information, but also the emotion, the consideration and kindness behind the message. Has to be, there has to be more words there to do that.
Or emojis. Thanks so much, Chris. Great to have you on the show again, and thanks for, you know, following the show for so long, and for being here a guest today. All the best for your further career, and pretty sure we'll connect again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Alexander. Be well. Bye, everybody.
As we were just talking about the pandemic, there's now two guests coming on the show, Emma and Matt. And that is a really, really interesting thing because if you are online now, you can see Emma is with her kid there. So that is kind of really kind of the one of the things that we really learned through the pandemic, that it's, you know, we are much more kind of getting into the private lives of people, the, you know, the back end. Her son is not doing well today, so she's taking care. Hi, Matt, Emma, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks, Alexander. Nice to see you.
That was little Harvey. Great to hear him as well.
Yeah, poor little Harvey's just been for a COVID test. But there you go.
Yep.
This is just indicative of my whole pandemic experience.
That is really so, so cute. I think that really speaks to what we wanted to shortly talk about, because when we recorded our episode, it was face-to-face in the office in Twickenham. And shortly thereafter, the pandemic hit. And you were asked to run your company through this pandemic. So tell us a little bit about how that experience was.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I remember you coming in actually, and we didn't know whether we should shake hands or not. I think it was February 2020, wasn't it? Around then.
Yeah.
But what I'd say is it's been hard work the last 18 months, but it's also been quite rewarding as well. I mean, as a business, we were quite fortunate. Some businesses have had a horrible time, but we were luckily one of the ones that didn't have too much of an impact in terms of loss of revenue. So maybe a bit of a dip at the start, but you know, we were lucky that it wasn't significant. And so I suppose in terms of what we needed to do and what we've kind of learned is we realized very quickly that we needed to be agile and adapt quickly. And one of my favorite photos from the company history is people walking out of the door with laptops and screens and chairs as we closed the offices. And we just said, well, you need to be able to work from home. And that was our first step in adapting. It was just take what you need, you know, no approvals process, just, you know, people were looting the office. It was great. but then it kind of, you know, went on from there. And we started to think very quickly about what we needed to do, because we'd been predominantly an office-based business. You know, what did we need to do to adapt to this new way of working from home? So thought, what's within our control? So we thought, well, communication is everything. So we started some things. And a lot of the things actually that we've started, we've kept, because we've realized, you know, even though people are now back in the office to a degree, but things like daily stand-up meetings, we put those in place on projects, and people who were previously remote workers were saying to us, we've never felt so engaged as we have now. You know, this is the pandemic and everyone's remote, but it's because we were then having kind of daily communication with everyone. We started having all staff meetings every 2 weeks and producing newsletters and having more social events and probably, you know, doing all the things that we probably should have, well, we thought we were doing beforehand, but we didn't realize that we could take it on a, you know, a margin further. So we started doing all of those things. And actually, you know, we've seen a lot of positive that's actually come from that as a business. But of course, there have also been challenges. I don't know, Emma, if you want to speak to the childcare challenges.
Well, one of the challenges of working with your other half in the same company, let alone running a business, is you're often in the same meeting at the same time. So we've had Batman joining us and we've had to adapt. But I guess I think many people have found themselves in the same position. So actually, a lot of people are very accommodating and accepting of that. And also just the flexibility to be sending emails outside of, you know, normal working hours. I think that has become a lot more of the norm. And it's very heartwarming, I guess.
Yep, yep. Yeah, and it shows much more kind of the people behind the, you know, the titles and the business, and it shows kind of we're all struggling with the similar things. I think Benjamin probably with his four kids can also tell some stories about that.
Yeah, I've realized my ability to hold a conversation and do a few other things like building a digger at the same time. I've definitely learned new skills in the last 18 months.
Yeah, and you don't even need to be in the same company. So you just have to have a husband or wife who's working at the same time. And it's, you know, I don't know how many meetings my kids spoiled, you know, with running into this and jumping on my chair and stuff like this. So that's, I wouldn't say takeaway because it's not over yet, but what is the aim of, you know, getting the advantage and disadvantages of, you know, what the COVID time taught us in terms of flexibility of working. I mean, obviously, you know, I suppose you cut down travel expenses as every company. So yeah. what is the takeaway, or might be the takeaway from after, you know, these 2 years of forced, you know, home-based working?
I mean, that's a really good question. I think that for us, you know, we've talked about some of the communication stuff that is definitely here to stay. I think that's been so positive for us. We've also, though, had to, you know, be mindful of other challenges and the things that you don't necessarily see if people are at home. So mental health challenges, you know, we've done what we can to kind of support there in terms of external support and increased contact and burnout as well. You've got to be mindful of that because, you know, I like working hard. I don't mind working hard. That's fine. But, you know, you can find yourself just sitting at your desk all day long and then right into the evening and you kind of forget to stop sometimes. So there's a bit of that you need to kind of be mindful of. But I think really, really for us, it's about, you know, trust and flexibility. That, and what we've seen certainly is that, you know, I've been so proud of our company. We focus on culture a lot. That's kind of what we're about. But, you know, actually trusting people and providing flexibility, it comes back around. And I think that's here to stay. And actually it's a positive because it allows you to take time out to spend with your children or pick them up from school and not have that expectation of being in the office from 9 to 5. You know, every day. Going back onto the one of the previous conversations in this podcast, it was about how do you get that contact with people that you wouldn't then meet at, you know, the kettle or the printer or what have you. And just a little thing that we started, someone had the idea with Veramed. We started this thing called the Vera Cuppa, and what it is a random selector that selects two people at random from the company to stop and have a half an hour cup of tea with each other. And some of the best conversations I've had in the last 18 months have been because of that, because I haven't had the opportunity to visit the offices or even the other offices. And through that, it's allowed us to create this kind of informal web of connections within the company of people kind of getting to know each other, that where they wouldn't have the opportunity to otherwise. So that's probably some of the takeaways, I think, for us.
Yeah, I think that is something that I implemented as well to kind of connect people. I wouldn't say randomly, because it's me doing the random side, but it's kind of connecting people in the teams together that haven't worked before together. So, which is kind of just making the group wider, kind of replacing a coffee machine, and not replacing, but at least kind of compensating for it a little bit. And that is, I think it's an excellent idea to just let people get the spirit of the office, of the colleagues, of the whole company, and rather than working isolated and single, you know, on a home-based desk and focusing on just getting the work done. So there's more than that. No, very good.
Thanks so much, Matt and Emma. And of course, it's great being colleagues now. See you later, I would say.
Thank you, Alexander. Thank you.
We've got our youngest member listening in.
Yeah. He's for sure the cutest listener ever, I would say.
We'll say goodbye before we leave further.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.